I'm Ben Sawyer, and this is The Road to Now. Guys, Bob Crawford is on assignment today, and by assignment, I mean he is out spreading love to the world with his band, the Avett Brothers. If you've ever been to a show, you know how that feels. If you haven't, go see what it's like. AvettBrothers.com, all their tour dates. But for now, I am here, and let me tell you, I have spent a lot of time sitting in my backyard the last few days reading a great book by our guest. The topic is the Civilian Conservation Corps, and our guest today is Neil Marr. Neil, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Ben.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I was thinking about, and I just want to maybe start off like this, is that in recent years, we've heard a lot of people talking about us needing a Green New Deal. And this has been the kind of catchphrase, Green New Deal, Green New Deal. But Neil, it might be fair to say that the first New Deal was in fact a Green New Deal.
That's exactly what I'm trying to argue in the book, is that we think of the original New Deal as just a work program to put people back to work during the Great Depression. But it turns out that Franklin Roosevelt was thinking about a second problem that was affecting the country. And this had to do with rivers that were overflowing their banks due to deforestation. Later on in the 30s, it was things like the Dust Bowl. So he saw an environmental crisis occurring at the same time as that employment crisis. And then he created all these programs to put people not only back to work, but also to conserve natural resources. As he put it, we could kill two birds with one stone. So the original New Deal was definitely a Green New Deal.
Yeah, and I agree. I think that when you're trying to teach the class about the New Deal, when you're doing the survey classes, it's far easier to get kind of focused on things like the controversy of some of the first programs of the Supreme Court, or you focus on things that continue to exist today, like the Fair Labor Standards Act or Social Security. And what gets lost in it is that this program, the Civilian Conservation Corps, one of the first New Deal programs, it was incredibly popular throughout these years. And in fact, you argue that the CCC, probably more than any other program, solidified national support for the New Deal itself.
Yeah, absolutely. As an environmental historian, a lot of my book is about how the CCC and conservation during this period transformed conservation and the ideas about nature. But the other side to the book's argument is that by creating this incredibly popular program, Franklin Roosevelt really was able to use it to increase support for his liberal New Deal coalition. So urban people, urban workers were really excited about the CCC because it gave them jobs. Rural people were very excited because a lot of the work that was being done was done in their districts. So it became, popular across the political spectrum, really.
So just to start off, give us some numbers on this, because I was blown away by how widespread this program was, by how many people who were involved in it, and just by the impact that this program had on the country.
Yeah, I was amazed when I did my research, when I found out how many people and how much work this program really entailed. So more than 3 million enrollees, young men between the ages of 18 and 25, enrolled in the Corps from 1933 to 1942. It planted 2 billion trees, for instance, which is half the trees planted in U.S. history up to that time. It conserved 40 million acres of farmland, which is about the size of California, I think. Built from the ground up 800 new state parks. So basically, if you go outdoors in America today, whether it's to a state park, a county park, or even walking across farmland, the landscape you're seeing has been influenced by this program back in the 30s.
Yeah. And, we still go camping, right? I mean, I live in Nashville. We've gone out camping and you see it. It's the CCC projects. I used to go when I lived in Boone, North Carolina. I would go out to the Blue Ridge Parkway, which people know. Yeah. Much of that was work of the CCC.
Right. That's near the Great Smokies, right?
Right.
Yeah. And some of my book is about the Great Smokies. The CCC basically built that park from the ground up.
Yeah. So the impact that it has on people's daily lives, I mean, the program was cut off in 1942 in the middle of World War II, and we can talk, or the beginning of World War II, we can talk about that in a minute. But before we get going into this project, because it is this momentous moment in American history that still is all around us, The thing you point out is that politically and ideologically, and in terms of the things that people are facing, it's a crucial transitory moment in understanding Americans' relationship to nature. So before we get into this program, I think for me anyway, a lot of people, when you think about politics and nature, there's kind of two highlights I think most people think of. One is Teddy Roosevelt, right? Teddy Roosevelt going out and setting up these national parks, kind of getting that ball rolling. And the other one has to do with the environmentalist movement of the 60s and 70s, right? The EPA. And, you know, and I guess the third moment is, where the heck are we now? We can get there later. So you argue the CCC is crucial in transforming this relationship. So could we go back and, to understand the difference between what Teddy Roosevelt was doing, you know, in the progressive era and then the environmentalist? Could you kind of start back at the progressive era?
Sure. So if we're going to talk about the progressives in, you know, the early part of the 20th century, Teddy Roosevelt's one of them who was thinking about the natural environment, and also, you know, professional foresters like Gifford Pinchot, who later became the governor of Pennsylvania. They were actually really, really good friends. And back then, this idea in the progressive era was, we have to rein in the inefficient use of our natural resources. We have to rein in sort of the inefficient functioning of these corporations, right? And the idea was that conservation was a way of using natural resources, but using them wisely. In other words, we should use trees and soil and water, but use it efficiently so we have it for the future. So this is where Teddy Roosevelt and Gifford Pinchot agreed, in the sense that Pinchot was a real believer in forestry. He was the first American to bring the practice of forestry back from Europe and really professionalize it in the U.S. And he really argued that if we want to avert a timber famine, which is what people were thinking they were going to experience, that we're going to run out of trees and wood, we have to start conserving these trees. Well, at that time, in the progressive era, there was an alternative view. And Teddy Roosevelt also sort of shared this view. And that alternative view was that, let's not use all our natural resources efficiently. Let's preserve some of them. Let's actually make them untouchable in a national park. And the real spokesperson for that was this guy named John Muir, who was a naturalist and a writer mostly out west in the Sierra Nevada mountains, but he wrote for these magazines in the east. So during this period, you had these two competing ideas. One was the conservation of natural resources, and the other was this notion of preservation.
I think it's really fascinating here because, you know, when we try to think about the narrative and we think about how, like, you know, events in one era of American history then translate into another era, you know, or how they affect it. I was thinking about it as I was reading your book. Thinking about the relationship to nature is a really good way, I think, of understanding the shift between the Gilded Age and the Progressive Era. Because the Gilded Age is just, you know, industry run rampant.
Yeah, it's a free-for-all.
Yeah, it's a free-for-all. And they're just strip mining things, like ripping down trees. There's no tomorrow. There's only money now. And so then you come into this moment with Roosevelt, with Teddy Roosevelt and the progressives. And their idea is, no, we can't do that. And like you're saying, Roosevelt wanted to preserve some of these areas, but a lot of the force behind this is actually, well, if we do this all now, then there won't be resources left to exploit in the future. And it's a kind of an interesting way, I don't think most of us would expect to find that actually industry and people who are more concerned about nature find themselves on the same side in terms of restoring forests.
Yeah, I mean, Gifford Pinchot was a Republican. You know, conservation in a way started out as a Republican issue, because there were business interests that wanted to maintain their business, profits, right? And I argue in the third, this idea of conservation and preservation begin to change because of this extremely popular program, which is the CCC. The CCC sort of takes conservation and plays with it in ways that make people start to think a little bit differently about it.
So the CCC comes out of, it's an early New Deal program. Just for anyone who's, you know, hasn't taken their class one in a while. What I love about the New Deal is a lot of it's just FDR promising a New Deal and then being like, all right, what is it? And going to his brain trust for it.
Yeah, what do I got that can work or not work? He tried everything out. He was a pragmatist.
Yeah, and it's fascinating. But you talk about in this book that this is one thing that FDR actually already understands and already has under his belt and actually already has like personal experiences that shape him, which immediately made me think about Doug Brinkley's book about Kennedy, you know, the conversation we had a few months ago. So could you talk about this? Like, the experiences in FDR's life that make him very well positioned to start a program like this when he comes into office as president?
Well, just like Teddy, Franklin Roosevelt also had these sort of two sides to his thinking about the natural environment. So first of all, Franklin Roosevelt was a conservationist. He took over sort of responsibility for his family estate up in Hyde Park, New York on the Hudson River. It was a 1,200-acre estate. He was a gentleman farmer. But he realized when he took over that property in 1910, he was about 28. He realized that his family was no longer growing prize-winning corn like it had a couple of generations before. And then he looked around and he saw all these massive gullies running down the property into the Hudson River. And he realized that his property was suffering from soil erosion. So he goes on and starts planting 500,000 trees on his property. I mean, he didn't do it, right? He hired people to do it. 50,000 trees a year he planted on his property to stop soil erosion. So he has this long history of being a conservationist. But at the same time, he's also extremely involved in the Boy Scouts.
I love this part.
He was the head of the Boy Scouts of Greater New York. He then becomes, I think, the leader of the Boy Scouts nationally. And he realizes that his interest in that has to do with taking young people, often urban kids, and bringing them out into the countryside, putting them in these little, you know, Boy Scout camps, and having them sort of be rejuvenated through this shift in their environment, right? In other words, the idea that a nice, good environment, a healthy environment could actually make people better. This was a very progressive idea as well. So Roosevelt not only helps to establish these camps for these Boy Scouts, but he also, for the first time, introduces a curriculum into the Boy Scout, you know, program that involves conservation. Because before this, the Boy Scouts carried their little hatchets and they chopped down trees and built fires and like they wrecked the place, right? He finally started teaching them, hey, look, you got to also respect nature. And that would help rejuvenate these young boys. So what I see in Roosevelt is that he has this idea of conservation of natural resources and, in a sense, this conserving of human resources through these Boy Scouts, taking them out into nature and making them healthy. And he brings those things together. They sort of feed into the idea for the CCC. And he does this first as governor of New York with a state program at the beginning of the Great Depression. Then he transfers that to the national level.
One of the things that you said here, though, that I want to talk about before we get into talking about the actual CCC, that transition from the Gilded Age, you know, how that affects the Progressive Era and then ideas moving forward, there is this notion of a crisis of masculinity.
Absolutely.
The YMCA comes out at this time, this idea that people living in cities and doing desk jobs were softening people, breaking them away from nature. Could you talk a little bit about that and how it influences this movement?
It's such a great point. And I mean, it does hark back to Teddy Roosevelt, his whole notion of the strenuous life. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt promoted this idea of a strenuous life. He was often filmed out in the woods on horseback or camping. He was filmed cutting down trees. He always had his shirt off, or at least his jacket off. So he was very aware and believed in this masculinity crisis, and he thought that getting out in nature would help solve that. And, you know, Franklin Roosevelt, you know, had a similar feeling. And this masculinity crisis has reoccurred over and over again throughout U.S. history. And in this case, one way that Roosevelt thought of solving this problem was to take these young boys, put them to work in nature, and transform them into men, right? Through the manual labor they did. But this crisis of masculinity is central to all the iconography of the CCC, to their internal memos, to their external publicity materials. It's all about taking these young, weak, undernourished boys from the cities and from the farms, and then through hard labor in nature, making them into healthy American men.
And that notion of a crisis of masculinity is very much embodied in what happens in the Depression. You have this breakdown. You know, ideology changes a little slower than economic and material conditions, you know, does. So you have this gap here. And one of the crises of masculinity that happens during the Great Depression has to do with unemployment.
Exactly.
When FDR comes into office, you're looking at roughly a 25% unemployment rate. And American masculinity has so long been tied to the idea that one works and provides for one family. And when the work is there, there's a correlation, right? I mean, there's a causation. People who want to work can go out. But during the Depression, what happens is people who want to work can't find that work. And young men left with no direction can frequently become a social liability.
Juvenile delinquency.
Yes. And so you have all of this coming into the beginning of the New Deal. And you say there's a lot of debate about, or not really so much debate, there's a lot of claims at the time for people who say, I had the idea for the CCC. I had the idea for it. One guy comes and tries to talk to FDR and, you know, ends up committing suicide out there because or trying to commit suicide because he's so, he so wants the credit because it's so popular. You know, you talk in the book about the fact that there's all these claims. What does FDR do that's unique? And you say he actually, what he does is he takes two concerns, he blends them together into something. And his unique idea is addressing these two problems at once.
Right. So just as he did with the Boy Scouts, he takes this concern regarding the degradation of natural resources and this concern about joblessness and sort of the masculinity crisis. And he, as he says, you know, we can kill two birds with one stone. We can conserve natural resources while we're conserving human resources. And the way he does that is he puts people to work, young men to work, doing conservation efforts, planting trees, stopping soil erosion, building parks. So it's a perfect solution. These two ideas flow together almost like two tributaries to a stream or a river. And what you get is the most popular, you know, New Deal program of the decade.
Now, the thing that's remarkable about this is, unlike a lot of the other programs, it's never really challenged in the same ways. You know, I mean, you've got the National Recovery Act, which is struck down by the Supreme Court, the Agricultural Adjustment Act. A lot of the first New Deal programs are struck down. CCC is widely popular. Could you talk about why people who might in the countryside, who might not otherwise want the federal government around, find this to be an appealing program?
Sure. People in the rural areas, at first, they were very much opposed to having these camps. So just to back up, the CCC put these young men into these camps out in the woods and out near agricultural areas, and they each housed 200 men. And there were 5,000 of them at one time sprinkled all over the United States. So at first, rural communities were quite opposed to having a CCC camp nearby. Their fear was that the camp would be filled with, you know, sort of urban city hoodlums, and they would be coming out to these rural areas and dating their daughters and causing havoc in the local towns.
It's like the classic, I'm worried about somebody from over there. Like, my wife grew up in Long Beach. I grew up in the country, and both of us were pretty sure that the bad guys were from the other place that we weren't from.
Right, exactly. And we have to remember that, you know, in the 30s, people didn't really move as much between cities and rural areas. So they weren't accustomed to these differences, right?
Right.
But what happened was, when these camps did move into town, there was an economic relationship that was forged between the camps and the communities. On average, every month, each camp spent about $5,000 in the local community for goods and services, everything from cleaning the uniforms and the bed linens to cooking the meals and getting the food for those meals, right? And then also, the young men got $5 per month for spending money. The other $25 went to their families. But they took that $5 and spent it in town, which accounts for another $2,000 per month per camp. So each town, each local community was getting about $7,000 a month from these local camps. And once that became known, the local communities were like, not only wanting camps, but when they were then announced they were going to move those camps for projects in different areas, they petitioned their politicians. They wrote letters to Roosevelt. No, please don't take these city hoodlums away, because they're incredibly good, you know, economics. And then other rural communities also benefited from the work the CCC was doing. So, for instance, in farming communities, the CCC actually reorganized farmscapes in ways that raised production on those farms. So the farmers were making more money. And then in recreational areas, like down in the Great Smokies, for instance, communities down there began to benefit from increased recreational tourism. So it was really an economic benefit that convinced these communities not only that the CCC was a good thing economically, but it also, I argue, sort of introduced them to the New Deal and Franklin Roosevelt and sort of government intervention in their lives. And they began to sort of reassess their relationship to the federal government. And I show in the book how many communities actually switched political, you know, affiliation in presidential elections because of, you know, not just the CCC, but exposure to the federal government in their lives that was beneficial to them.
Yeah, and that's particularly profound in an area like Appalachia, which had, you know, its origins, especially that part of the world, are, you know, the Overmountain Men, the legacy of running away from the government, right? And then after this, the legacy of dealing with, you know, the being pulled between the Confederacy and the Union, all that stuff's alive in people's minds. And to find the sympathy there with the federal government's incredible. One of the things you point out that's interesting to me is I think a lot of times when you say, you know, conservationism or preservationism, we think of the West. And you say that, I mean, these camps were all over the country. And you say the West was easy, but the East was tricky in terms of setting up these camps and getting these parks set up. Could you explain that a bit?
Sure. I mean, out West, there was so much sort of, I'm not going to say empty land, because that land had many, many people on it, really diverse communities of people. And the land was also taken from people, you know, hundreds of years ago, Native people. But in the West, there was more open space, also more land owned by the federal government, where they could put these camps, and they could keep them pretty far away from communities. In the East, that was more difficult. So what they did in the East was they also had a program where the federal government bought submarginal land, land that had been farmed and had sort of run out of its fertility. And they bought those properties and then turned a lot of those into what are now state and county parks. But they had to develop those parks. They had to build hiking trails and visitor centers and campgrounds. So they got the CCC to start doing that sort of work in the East. But you have Great Smoky Mountain National Park, Acadia National Park, and county parks in between, many of which were developed for recreational tourism by the CCC in the East. And that helped Roosevelt because it allowed him to make the claim that all these people in urban areas in the East now had in their backyards these beautiful parks and these recreational areas, and they could thank the New Deal for that. And this was a way that that notion of conserving humans, human conservation, it's a way that it shifted from the young men performing the work, they were being conserved, but then also ordinary Americans who could go and recreate in these parks. They made the argument that that too was a form of human conservation, because they were going out and becoming healthy. They were leaving the city, going to the Great Smokies and hiking, and that was conserving them as well.
Yeah, and you point out that it's clear. Like, these boys go from, like, living in cities where the Depression has hit hard and there's malnourishment and they don't have much chance to be outside, and they get muscular. Like, they come back home and, like, they're physical proof of the effectiveness of the program.
Yeah, so I should just say, we've talked a lot about urban enrollees. The CCC was 50-50 urban-rural, but it had this persona, this stereotype of it being a urban program. But in the promotional material for the Corps, they had booklets and pamphlets and plays and films and songs. In all of it, most of it, you see these young men with their shirts off. They're walking around with their axes and their saws and their, you know, shovels, and their shirts are off because their bodies have been so transformed, and they gained on average about 15 pounds in 4 months. They're constantly talking about their aching muscles, and they're showing it off. Like, they feel really, really different physically. And what I argue in the book is that they begin to see themselves as a natural resource that's being conserved and built up, in the same way they see the trees and the soil and the water that they're conserving as a natural resource. They sort of see themselves as part of this conservation effort.
I started reading this book yesterday, and then last night after my wife went to bed at like 10, I stayed till 1:30 reading it, and then got this morning and finished it up. But when my wife woke up this morning, she's also, you know, a history professor, I said, this book is great. I said, 3 million people in the CCC? And my wife said, nope, 3 million young men. And not just 3 million young men, 3 million hot young men.
Well, she was right. They look good.
Find a picture. Google or like web search CCC workers and tell me these guys are ripped, you know?
It's true.
So there's been that theory, right? That idea that Teddy Roosevelt had about rebuilding the physical self. And this had been kind of in the ideology of the time, you know, but primarily kept for the, you know, the upper classes who had that leisure time. And now this is the proof.
That's a huge huge, important issue that you just raised is that I didn't mention this before, but this whole notion of conservation, right? And even preservation, it was an idea that basically elites could think about and knew. So Teddy Roosevelt, Gifford Pinchot, you know, other wealthy people, and ordinary laborers, working class people, didn't have the time or really the training to be able to talk about the conservation of natural resources or parks, right? So it's in the 30s that that notion of conservation gets democratized. It goes from being this very, very elite thing practiced by professional foresters and agronomists and hydrologists to really being something that ordinary people throughout the country began to understand because of the popularity of the CCC.
You know, I guess the way I would describe it is that earlier on, it's the domain of experts who kind of look at this in terms of spreadsheets.
Totally.
And then once you have this in the people's backyards, they're like, no, this isn't on spreadsheets. This isn't quantitative. This is qualitative for us.
Yeah. And what, you know, the CCC during that period, there were women's groups that started doing their own tree planting programs. Schools developed curriculums around ecology and around conservation more than ecology. There were advertisements all over the country selling everything from maple syrup to shaving razors that were using the CCC and conservation to promote these products. It became like a fad. It was like a conservation craze during the 30s because of the CCC. And that pushed people into debating and arguing, actually, what is this?
Yeah, and that's where I wanted to go next, because one of the fascinating things here is, like, on the outside, you go, wow, there is broad consensus, broad support for this. But you say that from before this, there are divides over what this actually means and what it's for. But right. And then those evolve in the context of the CCC. And when you come out the other end, you have a different view of what this means. Could you talk about those different strains of thought and how they come to conflict?
Sure. If you follow the CCC's sort of work, it sort of lays out each idea. So in the beginning, the CCC focused on forestry, planting trees, stopping forest fires. And that was really the core idea behind conservation back in the progressive era, right? To use natural resources efficiently. Well, in the later 30s, the CCC expands its work into recreational development. And that broadened it to include this idea of conserving humans, human conservation, right? A second idea, which sort of goes back to Teddy Roosevelt and the strenuous life idea, right? So those two were sort of there, and they come out, they flourish again during the CCC's time. But there were two ways the Corps was also criticized, and those also raise dialogue and debate around just what is conservation really. So first of all, there were wilderness advocates, Bob Marshall, for instance, and the Wilderness Society, who were really upset with the CCC for instance, building roads, motor roads through these national parks, right? Dividing up these wild areas and making them much smaller. And the Wilderness Society came out strongly against the CCC because it was destroying wilderness. So it wasn't preserving land. It was actually destroying, you know, wild land. So there was this wilderness idea that conservation needed to include the preservation of wilderness. And then another group, ecologists, began to look at the CCC's work and say, hey, you know, you're conserving resources, but you're really messing up the natural environment when you're doing it sometimes. So for instance, the Corps drained a lot of swamps for mosquito control, but that really, really affected, for instance, bird migrations and biodiversity. Or they planted in tree stands, they planted the same species of trees in straight rows for future timber harvest. Well, that's really not good for biodiversity either. It also makes those trees much more susceptible to diseases and fire. So ecologists were like, look, your conservation is not the only way to go. We have to think of, you know, ecological practices as well. So conservation goes from being one idea about natural resources to also including recreation, and then additionally including ideas about wilderness and ecological health. And people debate this. What is it? Is conservation A, B, C, or D? And I make the argument that it's that debate, that dialogue, and that disagreement that pushes the idea of conservation towards a much, much broader idea, which we now call environmentalism, right? Which isn't just about natural resources. It's about recreation and health and wilderness.
It's fascinating, all of the cases where, you know, species are imported. I know, like, back in North Carolina, there's a type of ivy that was brought into a kudzu.
Kudzu.
Yeah, to deal with erosion. And it's great for dealing with erosion, but then it takes over everything. And now you've got to deal with that. It's this balance, huh?
You know, we have to look back and say, in the 30s, the science of ecology was in its infancy, right? So we didn't understand all of these relationships as well as we do now. So I think that I'm not saying we need to forgive the CCC for those mistakes, but at least we can place them in a historical context and understand that the intent was correct, but they just didn't know enough to ensure that they were doing the right thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, my philosophy is always to look back on people. Everyone's flawed. The question is, were they trying to push the world in a direction that we today would, see as positive, or were they trying to halt that progress or push in other directions? And unquestionably, the CCC has this legacy. But in 1942, despite it being so wildly popular, Congress kills the program. Could you talk about the reasons behind that?
I mean, basically, it was because of the war. The war effort just sort of becomes paramount. The CCC tries to shift, and they try to assign many of the enrollees to military bases, to build up those bases, to do sort of military preparedness work. But the finances just begin to shift towards the war. And it turns out that about 80% of the young men in the CCC go directly into the military. You know, they were in camps that were already run by the Army. So the CCC camps were overseen by the Army. And then when the young men went out into the field to do their work, it was overseen by the Department of Agriculture or Interior. But that experience with the Army fostered a pretty easy transition into the military during World War II. And that was one of the fears of people when the Corps was first created, was that this was going to militarize youth, because Hitler had a very similar program in the early 1930s. Yeah.
This is the 30s, really. I mean, the widespread kind of co-option. You know, the basic principle is everybody wants to be something, a part of something bigger than themselves. And in times of the Great Depression, you feel isolated. You know, in this global economic crisis, you feel isolated and you want something bigger to believe in. And I always look back at the 1930s and what goes on in the rest of the world. I mean, you've got Hitler, you've got Stalin, you've got Mussolini. And I think of the genius of the New Deal programs just from so many different directions. It's always funny to me that people today will be like, that was communism, that's socialism. It's like, well, if you look at it, every one of these programs that I'm aware of the New Deal programs, was actually, at least partially, if not entirely, meant to make markets work.
Exactly. That's the whole thing, is it? FDR gets criticized on both sides. So liberals claim that the New Deal was too conservative. It was trying to change, it's trying to work within the capitalist system to make it better. So they criticize it for that. And then people from the right claim it's communist or socialist, which is not true, because what you just said is correct. It was trying to make the market function in a better way, a more equitable way. Yeah.
It's really, I think it's, for most people, it's hard to imagine what the world looked like prior to, really, I would say 30, the mid-1930s, with Social Security and the Fair Labor Standards Act. I mean, just imagine that when FDR takes office, there's basically no way for anyone who's not a upper class to fully retire. Child labor is not banned at all. There's no minimum wage whatsoever, limits to a work week. And these programs come in, and if you look at them, you see, like, Social Security, okay, it allows people to retire, but what does it do? When you've got, you know, when you're facing a 20% plus unemployment rate, that pulls older people out of the labor market. When you end child labor, that pulls children out of the labor market. When you require, essentially a 40-hour workday and minimum wage combined, two 12-hour shifts at a factory turns into 3-hour shifts at a factory. And then you protect organized labor so they can bargain outside the bounds of the market at a time whenever there's surplus labor across the board. And the Agricultural Adjustment Act, obviously, just burning fields of crops and slaughtering livestock while people are starving.
Yep.
So it's all there. So in 42, it ends. And again, talking about the tangible results of this, you know, the idea, you know, this idea coming into practice, you see the physical improvement of the people in the program. And then you have 3 million young men who are now fit, able to survive. And when the war comes, you have another tangible impact of that physical production on their bodies in the war.
Yeah, I mean, they move pretty easily right into the military. But they also, later on, many of them don't forget their experiences with conservation. So let me just back up a little bit. When they're in the Corps, they were learning about soil and water conservation and forestry through their daily job, right? They had foresters and hydrologists and soil scientists who were teaching the young boys about what they were doing, right? If they were contour plowing a farmer's field, for instance, helping the farmer do that, they would learn that those contour plows help to keep the water on the field for longer and it would help those crops. So they began to learn about that. And then the Corps had this incredible education program. After they worked, they could take all these classes. Now, a lot of them learned how to read and did automotive work or learned how to type. But many of them took classes in forestry or soil science. And they used that later on. Many of them actually returned to conservation bureaus in the federal government, to the Department of Interior or the Department of Agriculture or the Bureau of Land Management, and took on those jobs or even founded their own, you know, conservation groups.
So you get into this program. One of the questions I have for you, you know, one of the things, like my dad was in the Army, right? And for years after, still to this day, I think he still keeps in touch with people he was in the Army with because it brought people together.
Yeah, yeah.
And you have, especially when people were in war together, you have gatherings later on. Do you know of any like gatherings? Like did certain camps get together like 10 years later, 20 years later?
Absolutely. And there's a National CCC Alumni Association that meets down, it usually meets down in Luray, Virginia, which is where the first CCC camp was. They've been meeting for decades. You know, these men are, you know, we're losing a lot of them because they're getting pretty up there. But they have an annual alumni reunion at a CCC camp where they all get together. We have to remember these working class young men, you know, they didn't have the college experience that many people have today. So going away for a year or two and being with other young men their own age was really a seminal moment in their lives, like a changeable moment, just like going to colleges today. You know, we have to remember this is the first time these young men are really separated from their family. They're with other young men their own age, and they're sort of on their own for the first time. And it transforms them in a way, I think, that in some senses college does today. So they come back feeling very, very different, maybe more confident, more adult, and they remember it as a really, really important period in their lives.
Yeah. And this is the thing that I'm constantly pointing out to my students in the classroom, which is you've been sold a bunch of numbers for why you come to college. And I get that. But you're going to miss the one really important thing that is undersold at college. It's the community. It's the fact that you're surrounded by ambitious people who are from other places. It'll be the first time in your life that your friend base, if you do this right, your friend base won't just be the people you happen to have grown up around. And you can find people based on interest and ambition and worldview and not just proximity.
One thing I want to just mention also about this idea of community is that for all the great things the CCC accomplished, there were some serious flaws with who was able to accomplish it in the Corps. And I think we have to remember that and we have to talk about that a little bit, if that's okay.
Absolutely. I mean, this is one of the problems of the New Deal is in the local level and some degrees in the federal level, it is exclusive and it is it does not give everyone the same opportunities.
Right. So first of all, women were not allowed in. There was one CCC camp or a couple. I've heard one. I've heard half a dozen. The one I know of was a CCC camp for women in Bear Mountain State Park, right near where Franklin Roosevelt lived, and Eleanor Roosevelt spearheaded those camps for women, and they wouldn't let them do conservation work. They had them do domestic skills like cooking, cleaning, taking care of their kids. Older men were not allowed in the CCC. African Americans were allowed in, but were placed in segregated camps, and Native Americans were in a completely different and separate and not equal program. So if we had a new and improved CCC, it would have to be way more inclusive for us to get that community that you're talking about that I think would be representative of our society today, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think the New Deal has such a transformative effect on America. I'm kind of working on a series about World War II and how it really changes the world or changes America. And if you want to know how effective the New Deal is in terms of giving advancement to people, in terms of new opportunities, in terms of social leveling, all you've got to do is look at the difference between the groups of people who could access the benefits of the New Deal. And I include in this also the GI Bill. look at the difference today in the statistics of those who could benefit from those programs and those who could not. And you can see it right there. I mean, right now the black poverty rate in America is double, or more than double the white poverty rate. There's only two ways you could explain that. One is that, you know, black people are inferior. That's stupid, right? The other way you could explain it is that something happened. And people who want to trace these things back to slavery, it's like, that's part of the story. But the New Deal itself and the programs that follow, their exclusionary impact on the country lives on with us today.
Yeah. And I think a new and improved CCC, not only would it have to be, you know, more inclusive, but it also should focus many of its projects, you know, not so much on, I mean, on rural areas for sure, and on parks and farms and forests, but also I think on frontline communities, especially that are facing problems with the biggest environmental, you know, crisis of our time, which is climate change. So, for instance, if they had projects that were in inner cities, like in the city of Newark where I teach, and you had CCC camps there, diverse sets of enrollees working on, you know, climate mitigation infrastructure in the city of Newark, or building small pocket parks in the city of Newark, or even trying to, you know, install solar panels on rooftops in the city of Newark, I think that environmental justice sort of angle would need to be addressed as well, along with this issue of climate change, which could be, you know, the driving force behind a new and improved CCC.
So there's broad support for these programs. And what's fascinating to me is that you move into this era of the 60s where you begin a new environmentalist movement. And it's different in a lot of ways because instead of being focused on like parks and outside of the city, now it's the degradation of the cities and what's happened there with the EPA. But still, even then, you look at the Environmental Protection Act, broad support for that. And this is something that unites people from the country and the city. And today we find ourselves in a situation where something that for so long and in such different eras had broad support, and we find that to be divisive. When you look back at the story of the CCC and moving forward with environmentalism in the 60s, like, how do you explain this story? Why have we gotten to the point we are now where something that was for so long considered by most people to be the general interest is divisive to us?
I think it's really interesting, and I think of it more as like an evolution. It's a very, very good evolution, I think. I think in the 60s and 70s, people took a lot of the ideas from the 30s and wove together this notion of environmentalism, right? A notion of preserving land for the sake of preserving it, using resources efficiently, maintaining ecological health, and also preserving wilderness. But I think some people felt, and this is partly true, that it was really a middle-class white movement. And it was necessary, and it created a lot of good policy through these, you know, environmental laws in the 1970s. But I think what was left out of that equation was, again, people who are, you know, have fewer resources, and people who are perhaps minorities and working class people. Where did they fit in, for instance, the creation of Yosemite National Park? I mean, they don't really feel, I think, a place there, right? So now we have what's called the environmental justice movement, which is in some ways, I think, portrayed as a corrective to environmentalism. So environmental justice is about communities that are experiencing environmental inequalities and how they are trying to fight to correct those and make environmental pollution more equitable. What I wish was that instead of environmentalists and environmental justice activists sort of being a little bit at odds with each other, I wish we could come together more. And I think they are. I think that the environmental movement has completely embraced environmental justice as a key central, you know, goal of environmentalism. But instead of thinking of them as two separate movements, I think that we should try to think of them as integrated more, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Now, we've heard talk about the Green New Deal. I feel like some of that's kind of passed a little bit, but there's clearly work that needs to be done. And we're at this moment where things are divided. What do you think that people looking at trying to solve these problems, what could they take away from the CCC and the way that Roosevelt handled it that might be useful moving forward?
I mean, I think on a political front, the way that Roosevelt embraced and sort of appealed to both the left and the right. I mean, he found something that, you know, economically appealed to more conservative people, And then through its sort of social welfare appeal to people on the left. And I think that it would be great if we could do that today. I'm just not sure we can. So, you know, President Biden proposed a new CCC when he was first elected. It was only one paragraph in a larger legislative proposal. But I think that it was sort of attacked on the right for being, you know, a government spending program. What I think that we forget is that the money that went into the original CCC did not just go to those enrollees. It went to the enrollees. It went to the enrollees' families. It went to local communities that were situated near those camps. And then it went to build an infrastructure that created a tourist industry. It went into increasing production on farms and in forests. There's a real economic benefit to a program like a new and improved CCC that I think gets overshadowed by, you know, the costs and this socialist, you know, program. So I guess if we could maybe focus as much on the economics and the economic benefits of a program like this, as well as the environmental benefits, just the way Franklin Roosevelt did, right? Kill two birds with one stone. If we could do that again, it might be successful in bringing the right and the left together. Although in today's moment, I'm not sure how much of a shot we got at that.
We got to get sick of this eventually, don't we? I mean, we got to just be like,
I agree.
We got to be like, what does he like? I don't like that. That's the thing I don't like now. I don't like whatever he likes.
I mean, I'm tired. Aren't you fatigued by it?
Everyone's fatigued by it. Everybody that I talk to, my friends who are conservative, my friends who are liberal, they're all tired of it. And somehow they're convinced it's the other one who's doing it. And I was like, man, if you guys get together and just sat down and had a beer, you would find that you guys agree on like 93% of things. And the other seven things are, they matter, but not worth it.
You know, it's funny because I wrote, my second book was on the 60s. And it's thought of as like one of the most divisive periods in American history, right? But at least back then, it seemed in the research I did that people could talk to each other. You know, the hippies could talk to their parents, you know, if their parents were, you know, conservative, or, you know, the anti-war activists could talk to a military guy, and they're not going to agree, but they could still talk. And I just think today that's more difficult to do.
You know, we had other things to talk about. You've got a book, you know, on the space program. We're going to have you back to talk about that at some point.
And I would love to come back and talk about Apollo and hippies and anti-war activists and the women's movement and environmentalists and all that. So I'd love to come back, Ben.
Yeah, and you're friends with Bart Elmore. Maybe sometime we'll do a roundtable and bring you guys in here.
I would love that. I would love to hang out with Bart online and talk about history, Southern history, and also history in outer space. It'd be great.
And one of my favorite things to do is to get lots of smart people together and just listen to them. So
yeah, that'd be great.
Well, even just one smart person is great to have on the show. Neomar, your book is Nature's New Deal. And I got to say this. A lot of times we have people on the show who the book's just come out. Your book came out in 2008. And I love moments like this where I'm like, I would say, how did I miss that book? But I know how I missed that book. I was in grad school at that time and had a list of like 300 other books I had to read. But man, it is great. And I hope that you guys listening, go out and get this book. It's so well written. And Neil, I hope that you see a bump in your book sales here, because that means that you're doing well and all the people who bought the book are doing well too, because they're reading a good book.
I appreciate it, Ben. And I'll tell you that it was written so long ago that this morning I reread much of the book to get myself ready for the interview. So thank you for helping me revisit the younger Neil as a historian.
Well, it's great having you. Neil, where can people find you if they want to find out more about your work?
Neilmaher.com, NEILMAHER.com. That's my website. It has everything on there, announcements for upcoming talks, articles, books, links to pieces in, you know, New York Times and Washington Post and stuff like that.
Excellent. And all those links will be in the show description wherever you're listening to this. So Neomar, thanks for being on the show. Have a great day.
You too, Ben. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Road to Now. We hope you enjoyed this episode. And if you did, could we ask that you share the word about the show? That would be fantastic. You can give us 5 stars on whatever app you use. If you do it on Apple Podcasts, please give us also a little review. That helps spread the word. If you know someone who would like this, shoot them a text. Let them know. Say, hey, here's a great episode you might like. That makes you a better friend, right? You're sharing something great that makes your friends happy. Oh, that's that. Speaking of friends and being happy, we'd like to say a special thanks to our supporters on Patreon, with a special shout out to our Washingtonians. Tanya Marsh, Mary Hocking, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Big White, Matt Williams, Team Martin, Ann Williams and Frank Edwards, Nate Farrer, Jennifer and Magnolia, Regina Devine, and Chris and Teresa Adams. If you're enjoying the show and want to support our work, just head on over to patreon.com/theroadtonow, where you'll find uncut episodes, bonus episodes, and can even make your way onto the list I just read. That's patreon.com/theroadtonow. Our patrons make the show happen. For more on our show, visit our website, theroadtonow.com, where you can quickly search our back catalog and find links to content. And it's a good website because it was made by Seven Ages Design. Check those guys out if you need a website. The Road to Now, this very podcast, is hosted and produced by Bob Crawford and Ben Sawyer. Our associate producer is the legend Gary Fletcher, and our episode today was edited by the same man, Gary Fletcher. Our theme music today is Paul DeFiglia. For Bob Crawford, this is Ben Sawyer. Take care.